Good morning, I'm Shannon, I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
That was quick.
So.
You said it's going to be quick, no announcements, nothing? Okay. I'm very grateful to be here this morning. Thank you, Blue Ridge Speakers Group. Thanks, Billy, for asking me. Thanks, Russ. Good job. Ross, is it Ross? I got to mention him, right? I'm supposed to mention. Okay, thank you very much. I am nervous. I get nervous up here. And, you know, I had a great text from a friend last night that said, when you get nervous, if you speak and you start to shake, it's God shaking the truth out of you. So so that was a nice little thing to bring today in. My sobriety date is July 16th of 2009. My home group is the Lake of the Woods Living Series group out at Lake of the Woods. We meet on Monday evenings, and we are Lake of the Woods, for those of you that don't know, is on Route 3, halfway between Culpeper and Fredericksburg. So if you're ever out that way. And let's see, where should I start? I do have a sponsor. I'll start a little bit with my background. I grew up in Northern Virginia, and a little bit like Dave was saying, and great job, by the way. Thank you for opening up and said I didn't have to do that at 9:30. So, okay. I grew up in Northern Virginia, and same thing. My parents will be married 55 years come this July. I grew up a very normal household. Grew up in a townhouse in Burke, Virginia. I have an older brother who's 6 years older. My parents are not alcoholics. My brother is not an alcoholic. I grew up in just your basic suburban life, you know, a dog and a cat, and nothing really bad ever happened. Nothing really good ever happened. You know, it was a very wonderful childhood, a great life. I can remember the first time that I can ever remember tasting any kind of alcohol. My dad, you know, like I said, they weren't alcoholics. My dad was one of those ones that during football season, he would get a six-pack of beer, and we had a little refrigerator downstairs in the basement, and he would get a six-pack and put it in the fridge so he could have one or two, you know, while he watched the football game. So one day I was down there, I was maybe 8 or 9, I was young, and I said something like, "Hey, can I have a sip of your beer?" You know, and my dad probably thought that old great thing of, "Oh, I'll give her a sip and she'll hate it so much she will never drink again," right? You know, that old thing. And so he gave me a sip of his beer, and it was Stroh's beer, and my dad did manage to accomplish one thing. I have never drank Stroh's beer ever again. That was the one and only time. But his plan to cure me of ever drinking didn't work, obviously. But seemed like 14, 15 seems to be an age that pops up in these meetings a lot. And I was 14 when I can remember that I really started drinking. I had my best friend at the time, Lisa, was the youngest of 6 children, and she came from a divorced home, and her mom was awesome, but her mom worked as a waitress nights. So it was, you know, she was with her older siblings a lot, and it was great because they knew where all the great parties were, obviously, right? And if they weren't going to the great parties, the great parties were coming to their house. So that was when I can remember the first time I really started drinking. And, you know, I never felt like I didn't fit in. I really didn't. I never felt insecure and I really didn't feel that way. I remember drinking, and I just liked the way that it made me feel. I just liked it. It was fun. I just liked it. And I can remember looking back now, one of the first times that I drank, maybe the fourth or fifth time, and it was we were at a park. My girlfriend Lisa and I were at a park, and she was kind of seeing the guy, and they went off to go make out over on a park bench. And so I was in the back of this VW bug by myself, and the guy was older, and he'd gotten some Seagram's 7, and 7-Up, and put it had a big gulp cup and poured it in there. And I remember I'm sitting in the back of this car by myself drinking this. I remember it tasted horrible. I remember it burned, and it was disgusting. But I can remember at that age not thinking that I wasn't going to drink it because it tasted gross. I remember thinking, well, if I drink it really, really fast, you know, then the taste will go away. But the option at that age, even then, of not drinking it wasn't the option. The option was to drink it fast. That was my solution. And so I did, and I got drunk, and, you know. But that was pretty much how it was. I mean, I just always seemed to, on the weekends, there was always parties, there was always beer, there was always, you know, older kids. And like I said, if there was an option to drink, why would I not drink? And there wasn't any thought of, well, just have one or just have two. I mean, that wasn't the way at 14, you don't think that way. At 15, you don't think that way. So I went on pretty much my all through high school, and that was pretty much how it was. And I didn't get into trouble, and I, you know, went to school, and I didn't get the best of grades, but I, you know, certainly wasn't a bad student. I wasn't a bad kid. And but on the weekends, we would drink. We would go out and party, and we drank. And, you know, one of the first times, and this is interesting because I was talking to somebody about this story the other day. My girlfriend Lisa, one of the other great things about her was not only was she the youngest of six, but she didn't drink. She never does. She never did. She still doesn't. And so as we got older and she got a car, it was great because she was always a designated driver. So I never worried about driving. So to me, that never became a consequence. Because she always drove everywhere we went, and I could drink. But I can remember, and it's funny, I was talking to somebody this morning about how even though we tell our story and it's the same story, and people may hear you say the same story, our perception of things as we get sober changes over time. And my girlfriend Lisa, when we were in juniors in high school, two of her sisters were hit head on by a drunk driver in their neighborhood. And one of her sisters was killed immediately. And he was a young guy, and I remember he was probably maybe in his 30s, which seemed old at the time. But he was a young guy, and he had two little kids and lived in their neighborhood. Anyway, it hit her head on. But where I'm going with the perception of this is that I can remember then being like how everybody around was just like, oh, this guy, oh my gosh, yeah, how could he have these kids and how could he drive and how could he do this and oh, he should be locked up forever and just how horrible this guy was. And I'm thinking he could be in this room now. You know, it's like our perception of people and the way that we, you know, as we, be, you know, as being alcoholics and we hear things and we know things, it's different. And I can remember how he was just like this evil person back then. But now I look at it differently. You know, now it's you know, it was still a tragic thing that happened, but I certainly don't I don't look at it the way that I did then. And you know, and I remember though that her mom just had this amazing this amazing forgiveness for him immediately, and it was an amazing lesson. But anyway, so go forward a little bit, graduate from high school again, just trucking right along with my life and no consequences, nothing. You know, drinking on the weekends, the whole thing. And but there was something, when I graduated from high school, my brother did me a really good favor. He was 6 years older than me, and he, being that he had already gone through the route of graduating and going to school, he went to George Mason right out of high school. And he flunked out after his first semester. And it wasn't because of drinking or drugs, it was because he loved golf. And so he would get up, and, you know, and we all addictions are different, so we don't all, you know, it's not all the same. And he would get up every day and say to my mom, bye, go to class, and he'd go play golf, you know, Berkeley Park, he'd go, you know. And I guess he just figured that when the grades came out, he'd explain it then. So finally, you know, hey, it was time to fess up, and he had failed out. Well, he had to pay my parents back every penny of that tuition, every single penny. And my parents were not strict. They were not. They still aren't. But they were strict about certain things. There was a couple things that they held pretty steady to, and that was one of them. And so I remember 6 years later, I remembered that, and I remember thinking, if I go to college, I'm going to want to party. I knew it. I mean, I knew then that if I went away to college or once I mean, I wanted to be on my own. I wanted to do my own thing. And going to college was not going to allow me to do that. I was still going to be told what I was supposed to do. So I went to a business school. I went to Washington Business School for a year, and I did great. I did perfect because I knew it was a year long, and then I was going to get out and I was going to get a job. And that's exactly what I did. And the whole time, I went to school. I got good grades. I partied on the weekends, but, you know, I was doing what I was supposed to be doing. And I got out of, when I was 19, I graduated from there, and they placed me in a job in Old Town Alexandria. So, Dave, you'll know where that is. And I got a job for a construction development company, and it was awesome because construction people drink. You know, they do. You know? Not like everybody else doesn't, but they really do. They, like, you know. Like, it's awesome. I mean, it's great. It was perfect for me. So, I mean, we used to have these things called, there was one of the guys that was one of the superintendents that he had this briefcase, and we called it court dates because he could fit 4 quarts of beer into his briefcase and sneak it into the office and nobody would ever know. That it was awesome. So, but anyway, and being young in Alexandria was a great place because you could go down to the waterfront and just go from pub to Irish pub to this and that. And I mean, it was great. You never had to get back in your car. It was awesome. So, for a drinker, it was great. And that's what I did. And I worked and I paid my bills and I got up and I was at work every day and I may have been hungover every once in a while, but you know, who cares? I still went to work. I still did what I was supposed to do. And I went out drinking every single night. I went to happy hour every night because why wouldn't you? You know, happy hour wasn't just for Fridays. Happy hour was, and happy hour on Fridays started earlier. You know, it started at like noon. It did. And I figured out that if I didn't go to lunch Monday through Thursday, that I could save it all up. And then on Friday when I left at noon, I didn't feel bad about not coming back because I had saved up all those lunches. That's what I, you know, somehow in my brain that worked out. And luckily my bosses drank so I could convince them of the same thing. So, you know, it worked out fine. But the funny thing is, you know, looking back, there's all these little God moments that God puts in your life and kind of sticks in your brain, like you file them away, and then later on you go, oh, now that makes sense. I remember my boss at the time was 36 again. He was so old. I thought he was just old, and he had kids and was married, and he just didn't get it. But I'm like 20, 21, and he, and this is if I've been working for a few months, and I'm sitting in his office, and I can remember this day, like it was just, I can remember what I was wearing. I'm sitting in his office, we're going over these reports, and he's sitting at his desk, and I'm at this conference table, and he said something to me about, he was like, did you go out again last night? And I'm like, yeah, it was Wednesday. I was like, I mean, yeah, I go out every night. I mean, I did. And he went, oh. And he goes, really? And I go, yeah. And he looks at me with this funny look, and he goes, Shannon, he goes, your liver. And I thought that was the strangest thing that anybody had ever said to me. Who would say that to a person? Like, I mean, I thought, I can understand if you want to say don't drink and drive, or make sure you get to work on time, or brush your teeth, or, you know, before you come. Or, I mean, there was a whole bunch of things that I could have imagined him saying, but to talk about my liver, just, like, what did that have to do with drinking? I seriously did not get it. But here's the thing. I remember that moment. I still remember that moment. You know, of all the moments in my life, that one stuck. And so anyway, kind of this now we're back to the, we're about to the early 90s, and the recession hits. And so I end up being laid off from that job. And so I got laid off at the beginning of the summer. And I actually took just a couple months off because I'd saved money. And I didn't, you know, so I took a couple months off. And then I was like, well, gee, I guess I should go back and get a job. And my girlfriend Lisa again, she was like, hey, I work at this bar in Tyson's Corner. Why don't you come get a job with me while you're looking to go back to work full time, you know, at something else? And I was like, great, because who wouldn't want to work in a sports bar if you drink? It was perfect. So I went and I got a job at a sports bar in Tyson's Corner, and it was great because people in bars drink. You know, people that work in bars drink. People in the, you know, I mean, we all drink. But this was another industry that I got around that just, it was like, it was, we worked and then we drank. You know, we worked and we drank. We worked and we drank and we worked, drank while we worked. It was perfect. And so that it just continued my drinking career. But again, I didn't get in any trouble. I was always at work. I, you know, got there when I needed to be. I never slacked off when I was working. I may have been drinking, but I wasn't slacking off. And, you know, and I was paying my bills. So there wasn't a problem. There was no consequences. So for me, even though I drank every day, there wasn't a problem. It was, you know, everything was manageable. And during this time was when I actually met my first husband. I was young, and then I got into my first marriage, which I like to call my, you know, my starter marriage, my tester marriage, because some of us aren't sure, you know, if that's the road we're going to want to go down permanently. So we need to have that brief little tester marriage to see if, you know, we're going to like it. And but here's the interesting thing about this was he and I worked together very briefly at Champions. That's where I met him. And then he went to go get his master's degree up in Maryland. And so for the most of the entire time we were engaged, we only saw each other on the weekends. And we didn't know each other that well, obviously. We had never lived in the same house. We had never even been together for more than, I think, 4 days ever during the entire time we were dating and engaged. And so when we got married, he wanted, like, after work, he wanted to go, like, work out or jog or, I don't know, and I wanted to go drink. Because that's what I did. I mean, and so, but somehow, you know, this was back when people didn't have cell phones and you weren't talking all the time. I mean, so somehow, I guess, he didn't realize that I was going and drinking every day after work, and I didn't realize that he wasn't, you know? I mean, we just... Yeah, I mean, we were young and we didn't really know each other that well, obviously, but it was so, it became a problem immediately because, like I said, he did. It was like after work, he'd want to go, well, I was working and he was at home, but anyway, he'd want to go to the park and go play ball. I don't even know, but it just wasn't what I wanted to do. And so, but I was married and I didn't come from divorce. And so at the time this was it. I was in it for the long haul. You know, that's what my thinking was. And so when he said, do you want to go to an AA meeting? Because I think you have a drinking problem. And I didn't think I had a drinking problem, but I am a pleaser by nature and I wanted to save my marriage. And so I said, if this is what you want me to do, I'll go. And so we went to, it was a meeting down in Alexandria or Arlington, I can't, around that area. And it was this big, huge, gigantic church and it was in the basement. And I remember going in and I remember everybody being really friendly. And I remember that there was a lot of, people smoking and drinking coffee and everybody was really nice. And, that's really all I can remember, except for when we sat down, there was a speaker, it was a speaker meeting, and I don't remember anything the speaker said. I can't even tell you if it was a guy or if it was a girl speaker, but I remember that at one point in the meeting they said, and he came with me, he was sitting next to me, and at one point they asked if there was anybody here that, was here for their first meeting and would like to introduce themselves, as we do, and I didn't raise my hand, because I knew enough to know I wasn't going to say I was an alcoholic, because I wasn't an alcoholic. So it didn't make sense for me to say that. I came to the meeting with you, I did what you wanted me to do, but now you're going to want me to lie to these people, and I'm not going to do that. That's what I just wasn't going to do that, because there was something also in my brain that said, you cross that line, you say you're an alcoholic, then he's always going to call you an alcoholic. He will say you're an alcoholic forever, and he will say, you said you were an alcoholic, remember. So I wasn't going to say I was an alcoholic. So I didn't. And he, after the meeting, he was furious with me because, I wasn't taking it seriously and I wasn't. And I was. I mean, I went, right? What more did he want? I went. Anyway, that marriage ended shortly thereafter that for several reasons. But anyway, here's the thing is that after that ended, I'm now in my early 20s. And I remember after it ended, there was a sense of relief because it was apparent it wasn't going to work out. Our interests were just completely different. But I remember thinking, this is when the thinking process of the alcoholic, when you're looking back, is so obvious. In that, I remember thinking that the next person that I date was going to have to drink at least as much, if not more, than I did. That was a conscious decision that I made. It wasn't, he's got to be employed. It wasn't, that he needs to not be homeless. It wasn't, it wasn't any of those things. It was the top of the list of my criteria for my next boyfriend was going to be, he's got to be a drinker. I mean, that was because I thought that made sense because I didn't want to have to go through all of that stuff again. I didn't want to have to fight with somebody and I didn't want to have to worry about what we were going to do on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, all those nights. But see, that's not normal. But I really, there was nothing that triggered to me that was not a rational thought. I thought that was very well planned. I thought, I am planning this out. This is not going to become a problem again. So a little bit of time went on, and I actually accomplished that. And I got the guy that drank plus everything else. I mean, he was a great guy. And I ended up meeting what would become my second husband, my husband, and that I would stay with And he came from a great family, and he was a great person, and he was a hard worker. And because he went to work, and because he paid his bills, and because he was nice, and because his family was great, he wasn't an alcoholic either. We just happened to drink every day. We didn't drink the same thing, but we drank every day. And his name was Mark, and we ended up getting married in 97, and it was great. Again, here's my drinking all this time, and still, I mean, there's never been any consequences. Nothing. I'm just trucking right along with my drinking. And so it's great because when there's no consequences, it's so easy to rationalize that it's not a problem because it hasn't caused any problems. And so we drink every night. He works, I work, and we drink every night. And on the weekends, we'd start to drink around noon and we would drink till we went to sleep. And see, that was the other thing with me with drinking is if there was always an option of drinking and not drinking, I always drank. Why would I not drink? It was more fun to drink. Everything was more fun drinking. And it wasn't that I wasn't somebody that ever, that had, I always had fun, even when I wasn't drinking, but it was more fun to drink. But it just didn't make sense to not drink. And it didn't make sense to me to stop drinking once I started until I went to sleep. And I wasn't a blackout drinker. I never, you know, I think I had maybe 2 blackouts in my entire life. I wasn't a blackout drinker, but I always drank till I went to sleep or ran out. You know, and but you hardly ever ran out. Because when you have 2 people that are active drinkers and you both love to drink, you, between the 2 of you, you make sure you usually have enough. And so anyway, so come 2000, I give birth to our first son. And I managed, from the minute I knew I was pregnant, and I was one of those people that I knew I was not going to drink when I was pregnant, which meant, of course, if I could do that, then I wasn't an alcoholic also. But I knew. So I, when we were trying to go, I was taking pregnancy tests like 4 or 5 a day for some reason, because alcoholically we, you know, that one wasn't enough. I needed to take 4 or 5 a day. And so, because I wanted to know immediately when I was pregnant, because I knew I was going to stop drinking when I was pregnant. And I did. But it was so funny. I remember going to the doctor and being like, him being like, because I went to the blood test immediately. I want the blood test too. And he was like, okay. And I was like, he's like, well, did you take a home pregnancy test? And I said, yeah, I took like 19. And he goes, did you think the first one lied to you? Like, I don't, and the second and the third, and then, but looking back, that's true alcoholic behavior. You know, one's not enough. I got to know, I got all these to tell me that I'm pregnant. So anyway, I managed to, give birth to a very healthy baby boy, which was awesome. And then immediately went right back to drinking. And, but here's the funny thing about, I got to take some water, sorry. I'm nervous. My hands are still shaking, so I'm still telling the truth. Okay. Okay. Anyway, here's the funny thing, is when I'm pregnant with, okay, and this is the thing you women can, will be able to relate to, is you're pregnant with your first child, right, that you've waited. Okay, now I am 29, I'm not, this is, it's like, I waited, we tried for 2 years, I'm like, oh my gosh, this is so great, I have the marriage, I'm going to have the baby, and it's perfect, and I'm so excited. And so, you know, as women, your first baby, it's like you have the baby shower, right, the big, huge baby shower, and everybody comes and bring you lots of gifts and everything. And I thought, I'm not going to be able to drink my baby shower. That's just not going to work. Like, that's just not going to work. I did not have a baby shower before the baby was born. That was my decision because I was not going to have a party. See, I'm thinking this is normal. Honest to God, I'm thinking that there is nothing weird about this thinking. Again, I think this is great planning. So, I do not, because what do you need? I mean, the baby comes, they're little. What do they need? I mean, they don't need a lot, you know? I mean, they need diapers. I mean, they don't need, you know, they don't need a lot. So anyway, so I do not have a baby shower before the baby comes, and I purposely plan this, and I get my cousin, who's one of my best friends, and she's going to throw my baby shower, and we plan it to have it after the baby comes, right? And so we do. I mean, it's all planned, and people are like, hey, when's your baby shower? Like, when I'm pregnant, and I'm like, oh, I'm not having it until after the baby, and I don't, now I understand the weird looks. I don't think this is weird at all. Okay, so the baby shower is planned for 2 months after the baby, after my son James is born, and all the family comes. We have family come from Arkansas and Florida. I mean, all over the place. It's this big, huge thing. Everyone from my work is invited in the whole. And so, but it sounded weird to call it a baby shower because I'd already had the baby. So I had heard that over in England, they do this really cool thing in England that's called a sip and see, okay, which they do. They have baby showers before the baby, and then they have the sip and see after the baby comes, which is where people come and they sip tea and they see the baby, and it's this very proper, like, welcoming, and where they get to meet the baby. And I think it's perfect. That's what I'm having. But a sip and see sounded ridiculous because we knew we weren't drinking tea and that whole thing. So we renamed it a chug and hug. That is planning. That is planning. We had flyers that we sent to everybody with pictures of me holding the baby. Come to the chug and hug. Seriously, we sent these to family members, calling it a chug and hug. And this is great planning. This is great planning on my part. And here's the alcoholic thinking, because all these years later, there is still a little part in here that is amazed that has not caught on. I'm like, why are people not having chug and hug? Somewhere in some remote town, somewhere it has caught on, I'm convinced. But see, that's the thinking. That is the thinking that, to me, did not seem strange in the least as this is going on. So anyway, so that was, it's just such alcoholic behavior. It's insane. So a few years go by, 4 years go by, and then I give birth to our second son. And again, I managed to not drink during the pregnancy. And again, this is one of those things, and again, you women will know, is that your doctor says, a lot of your doctors will say, well, you can have a glass of wine, a glass of red wine every now and again. That made no sense. That made no, what a waste of time would that be? I mean, honestly, it was like, if I'm not going to, there was no sense in having that one glass. There was no sense. See, that didn't compute. I didn't get that. So, no, I did not drink during the pregnancy. So then I give birth to my second son. But now I'm really good at planning, because after the first one, see, when I was in with James, I remember people brought in a bottle of champagne, and I remember being like, oh, the nurses, and they were like, oh, no, it's okay. You can drink it. And I thought, they're going to let you drink in here? Like, in the hospital? Like, really? Like, you can drink in the hospital? So by the time 4 years later my second son is rolled around, I have the minis stashed in the bag, right? Because now I know you can drink in the hospital after you have a baby. So why would I not, you know? So I've got the minis stashed and bottle of champagne's ready to go and the whole thing. And so have the baby and of course I didn't breastfeed. Not that's probably a little more information you'll need to know. But a lot of people go, oh, you can't drink when you're. And I'm like, yeah, after the first one, I said, yeah, that's not for me. And really, it wasn't for me because I knew I wanted to drink. So, and that would be, it would be irresponsible for me to drink and then feed the baby. So I was going to be the responsible mom and not breastfeed, you know? Like, who cares about all that good stuff they say goes along with that? But, you know, I needed to be responsible. So, see, again, but that made perfect sense to me. I think I'm making the best choice. So anyway, so I have the second, my second son, and again, now I've got the minis packed in my bag, and it's all great. And my only problem was I figured out that I didn't have enough. You know, that was, I ran out like after day one. You know, what are you gonna do? And so anyway, 3 years go by, and we give birth to our third son, and again, didn't drink, and again, have a perfectly healthy pregnancy. And of course, another thing with, you know, rationalization is that, of course, when you manage to go 9 months and not drink, well, you're not an alcoholic. Because I never drank almost every day because I could drink, and why wouldn't I drink? So for me, you know, I wasn't somebody that went a month or two. I mean, I always drank except when I was pregnant. But since I could go 9 months, and by at this point, I didn't have the physical, it didn't have the physical, you know, effect on me where I didn't stop drinking when I became pregnant, have the shakes or throw. I didn't have any of that yet. So I thought, I can remember though, I was pregnant, and I had great pregnancies. I really did. I had really almost zero complications, but I can remember I slept like the best ever, right? And I mean, everything was just awesome, and I was so calm and relaxed, and I thought, I'm just the best pregnant person ever because I'm sleeping great, and all these people. It never dawned on me that it was because I wasn't drinking, that I was sleeping so good. Like, that didn't even occur to me till later. So I have have my third son, and now I have it planned. A month before my son is due, my third son's due, the first thing I pack is the minis. The first thing. And then I pack the clothes, and then I repack, and then I move the minis, and then I get more, and by like 2 weeks, yeah, and then I've got more, and then I rearrange them, and then I've got to put some in my purse, and I've got to put some here, because I don't want them all to be in one spot, because what if somebody opens it, and then there's all, so I've got them maneuvered all, I've got like 30 minis. This is ridiculous. I'm going to have a baby. I'm going to a hospital to have a baby. And for a month, I'm obsessing over how many minis of vodka I've got in my bag. I'm not kidding you. And I think this is planning. I really think it's planning. Because I've earned it. Because I've gone 9 months. That's a long time without a drink. Okay? So I have my son. And he was, oh my goodness gracious. My third son, I went into labor I had my first contraction at 12:15 in the a.m. and he was born at 2:04 in the morning, 2 hours, and I got to the hospital at 1:55, and yeah, they called me the 9-minute mom, and so it was very quick, and so he was out, and so it was a couple hours later, and everybody had gone back home, and I'm sitting in this hospital bed with my son, and he's perfect. He's just, you know, another perfect child, you know, just so blessed, right? So I have him. Everybody's gone. I'm sitting there by myself. And so I decide it's time for me to celebrate, right, because I've earned it. So I get out a mini. And I'm sitting on the bed, and I've got my knees up, and he's, like, perched right, you know, right up against, my legs, and I'm looking at him, and I drink the mini, and I'm waiting for that warm fuzz, you know, where your arms get warm and tingly, and it kind of just, you know, that feeling that we get when we're like 14 and we start to drink, that we chase for the rest of our lives, that we never get again. But I've earned it this time. I've gone 3 pregnancies. I haven't drank. I've gone 9 months, right? I've earned it, right? So I'm sitting there waiting, and it doesn't come, so I take the second one, and I'm waiting. Nothing. So here I am looking at this perfect blessing of this beautiful child that I just gave birth to, and I'm disappointed. That's what I'm feeling. I'm not feeling love. I'm not feeling like, ooh, you know. I'm feeling disappointed because I'm not getting the buzz that I think I deserve. Honestly, that's what I'm feeling. Because I'm an alcoholic. That's where I'm at. So, anyway, I go home, and again, it's great. Life's great. I'm a stay-at-home mom by now. I became a stay-at-home mom right after I had my first son. And so I've been a stay-at-home mom this whole time. Husband works. He goes to work every day. We've got 3 beautiful children. They're perfect. You know, we just, moved into a home right across the street from my parents, which is, you know, finally built our home. My husband was a builder. You know, he'd been a builder his whole life. He never built his own home. Finally got to build his own home. We live right across the street, literally. Our driveways line up across the street from my parents, which for some people, you know, might be like everybody loves Raymond a little bit, but it works, you know, and it can be, but it's a great thing. And, you know, and this is another one of those God moments because, you know, I can remember when we were getting ready to build on a different lot and, the lot came up for sale across the street from my parents. My mom called and I said to Mark, I was like, I know we were going to move in the neighborhood, but now the lot right across the street has come up for sale. And since they're your in-laws, I'm going to let you decide whether you want to live across the street from your in-laws. And his comment was, well, now instead of putting the lawnmower in the back of my truck and driving it over to your parents to mow their lawn, I can just walk it across the street. And so that was pretty much, so we ended up building across the street. But this is where those God moments, you know, come into your life because, you know, I'm thinking as we're building the house and you know, Mark's installing all of these handicap things and making doors wider and this and that because he's figuring, because his parents were older and he figured, you know, we need to do all this stuff because we might be taking care of your parents one day or my parents might have to move in. And so, you know, it's all this great planning. And see, what I don't know is that, see, God is preparing us for something totally different. And so we've got the 3 boys. It's perfect. We drink every day. I'm figuring, you know, but still no consequences. You know, no consequences. Everybody's still healthy. I'm healthy. Everything's good. We just got to coast. You know, life's great. We got a maid. We're just going to be like this for the next 50 years, and it'll be a perfect story. And then in October of 2007, when my youngest was, I guess, about 7 months old now, my husband was diagnosed with ALS, which is also Lou Gehrig's disease. And a lot of you may have heard of it from the Ice Bucket Challenge that went around last, the famous Ice Bucket Challenge. And as annoying as that was, you all know what ALS is now, don't you? Yeah, a lot of people didn't know before then, so I know it was annoying, but at least that, you know, some people know that didn't know before. But anyway, he was diagnosed with that in October. October 24th of 2007. And that was really when, you know, you spend your life, and this is another lesson on don't ever, you know, until you walk in someone's shoes. Because I can remember my whole life, if someone had said that you're going to be facing this later on in life, I remember I would have told you that I would have dealt with it very differently than I did. And we all think that we're going to deal with things differently than we do. I mean, usually. And when Mark got diagnosed, it was like the day that he was diagnosed. The day before he was living, and we didn't know what was wrong. And the day he was diagnosed became the day he started to die. I mean, it was just that simple. There wasn't, you know, but with ALS, it was, the doctors came in and 3 doctors, we'd gone, and he'd been through a bunch of tests already, and he'd been a neurologist already, and they'd run these tests. But to be honest, he'd been to a doctor in Fauquier County, and they didn't want to diagnose him because they'd never diagnosed anybody with ALS. They didn't want to do it. And so they sent us to UVA. And so he got diagnosed down there. And by now, you know, we knew something was wrong. To be honest, we were praying it was Parkinson's. You know, when I think, you know, now I think back and I'm like, when you're praying that you have Parkinson's, like that, you know, it's bad. Like if that's your best option. But, these three doctors, and we went into UVA and we asked them, we said, are we gonna get a diagnosis today? Are we still not gonna know? And they said, no, we'll tell you. And the three doctors walk in and it's just Mark and I sitting there and three of them. And I was like, wow, it's like three doctors. I'm like, aren't you special, you know? And came around and he said, yeah, he said, one's here to tell us the news and the other two are here to catch us when we fall. And that was pretty much it. And with ALS, it's not like other things where they go, okay, this is what you have and here's our plan of action. They said, we're sorry to tell you, but you do in fact have ALS. That's it. I mean, there's nothing. And so, like I said, and he had a great attitude about it. And I've always been a person that was, I was always a half glass full person. Always. And this just was, it was too sad for me. I couldn't compute it in my head. I couldn't compute it in my heart. I just didn't know what to do with this information. I didn't know how to deal with it. And so being somebody that I knew how to drink really well, I did what I did. I mean, and he did, we just drank. But the problem was that I stopped eating. You know, between the stress and everything, I just shut down. And the stress and the anxiety, and I wasn't eating. So, and looking back, you know, again, like what I was talking this morning, is that, you know, your perception, the more you tell your story, the perception of things change, and the longer we're in sobriety. And, you know, surely there was a part of me that thought, you know, who's going to blame me if I'm drinking at 10 in the morning? You know, look what I'm going through, you know. I didn't say that out loud, but there was surely, I didn't think about I'm drinking at 8 o'clock in the morning. I just thought, this is just too sad. It's just, I didn't know how to deal with it. And there's, you know, some of the family members that luckily I've worked out a lot of that with them that they didn't, you know, they didn't understand, you know, they didn't understand why I couldn't hold up better and why I couldn't, and I just couldn't. You know, it was just, so this went on, it was at the end of 2007 he was diagnosed, and then, so most of 2008, the drinking just got worse, and this is when the physical aspect of the alcoholism took hold of me. And, you know, I like to say, you know, I'm one of those people that all of those, I still have all of those not yet. You know, I never got a DUI, I was never lost a job, I never, you know, didn't lose my kids, didn't lose a marriage over it, the first one, but that doesn't really count. But anyway, but never, you know, it didn't count for a lot of reasons, but anyway, but no, so I didn't, but I have all of those not yet. You know, none of those consequences that like everybody else goes through, that they come into this program or that they're saying to people, I'm sorry, I won't do it again. I never had those conversations with anybody. Like, I never had that conversation with somebody saying, you know, I know we've been through this over and over and I promise I won't do it again. I didn't have that. Those are still all out there for me. You know, but the physical hold of it is what started to take hold. And, so 2008 started to become this, again, I wasn't a blackout drinker. It just became this gray mush of a year. And it just, everything, the days melded into each other and everything just got grayer and murkier and sadder. And, by the end of 2008, my kids, and again, this is where I say that, you know, that's why I know God places across from my parents, because, you know, my kids spent a lot of time at my parents' house, and because it was too sad. You know, my house was filled with fear and sickness and anxiety and stress, and, you know, I had these little boys, and, you know, so they, thank God, they spent a lot of time over my parents' house, and at the end of, and it just, it got worse, and it got worse, and it got worse. But at the end of 2008, it was 2 days before Christmas, my boys were all spending the night at my parents' house. And by now, my brother-in-law, Mark's older brother, had moved in with us to help take care of Mark. And again, thank, you know, somebody else that God put in my life. And he came in and was living with us. And so one of the boys ended up getting stomach flu. My mom said, can you come spend the night with your boys because I'm going to need some help. And my mom's asking me for help with my children. And so I did. I went over. I spent the night. And, of course, I'm in the throes of drinking all day long. And now the point has come I'm starting to shake a lot. But I'm not looking like I'm sick yet. But the throwing up has recently started. You know, the throwing up all the time. And so I'm over there, and I sneak into their liquor cabinet because I didn't bring anything over. I'm sleeping on the couch, and I take a shot of, I don't even know what it was, something they had underneath there, because, you know, my parents were one of those same people that, again, they weren't real big drinkers, but they had an entire liquor cabinet full of liquor in case anybody ever came over at Christmas or whatever, or things that were given to them, and, you know, from 20 years. And so I took a shot of something, and I immediately went to the bathroom to throw up. And so my mom, I come out, my mom's sitting on the couch, and I said, I'm like, oh, maybe I'm getting that stomach bug. And she looks right at me, and she goes, I don't think so. She says, I think you're drinking. She said, I think you're drinking. I think you're drinking all the time, and I think you're drinking too much, and we got to do something. And I sat on the couch, and I said, okay. And because, well, what else was I going to say? You know, we're not idiots to the point where we don't know when we've been caught red-handed, you know. And I said, okay. And so I said, I'll stop. And she said, okay. And I did. And I stopped for about 2.5 months by myself. Didn't know AA, no nothing, no, just stopped, you know. And so after about 2.5 months, I felt great. It was perfect, you know. And because I hadn't really, really, really gotten sick yet. So I'm better, I've got energy, I'm feeling good, everything's great, and so I figure by now I have cleansed my system enough, I'm perfectly healthy, I can go back to drinking, because I've proven that I can stop drinking, so I've proven that, and now I'm healthy, so I'm not sick, and so I start drinking again. And this is where that part of the progression of the disease, which I absolutely positively believe 100%. And, I'm one of those people that when I finally did come into the program, I've only picked up one 24-hour chip, but I was speaking with somebody about this on the way here, and we were talking, and I said that, you know, it occurred to me that I relapsed times before I ever came into this program. It just wasn't called a relapse because I had never come into this program and picked up a chip. You know, there's a lot of us in here that can say, hey, I only picked up one 24-hour chip, but how many times did you try and stop drinking before you came in? You know, I mean, if you had done that and you'd already been in the program, that'd be called a relapse. But because you hadn't picked up a 24-hour chip, then it's just, you're just back on, you know, you're off the wagon or on the wagon or whatever it is they call it. But so anyway, after about 2.5 months, I, you know, finally realized that I can drink safely. And so I start with a little, yeah, because I've proven it. So I have a little glass of wine. And again, this is where I talk about the progression of disease, because this is now like the beginning of March of 2009. And I honestly don't even know how quickly it happened, but it happened super quick. And it went from feeling like I've cleansed myself to a dying mess is what I was. And I got to a point very, very, very quickly where, let me see if I can run down the list. I was green from head to toe, literally yellow. My eyes were just completely yellow. I was throwing up nonstop. I couldn't keep any food. I just didn't eat, so what was the point? But I was throwing up all the time. I shook uncontrollably. I couldn't have written my name where you could have read it for $1 million. Honest to God, I could not have written my name where you could have recognized it. I remember one time I went downstairs in the middle of the night and I got a glass of water and I was walking upstairs, and by the time I had gotten up to the top of the stairs, my hands shook, and I had it with both hands. They shook so bad that it was just, I was drenched. The whole thing had just come completely out. It wasn't like a little shaking. It was like an uncontrollable, just violent shaking. I was losing all of my hair, and what I had left was very frizzy and dry. I bruised. If you just went by me with a, you know, just blew on me too hard, I would bruise. I bruised. When I first came in 2009, I didn't wear shorts the entire summer because I had such bruises on my legs. And, you know, people that didn't know, they were like, oh, God, that poor girl, her husband is beating her. Her husband is beating her up. You know, they don't know that he's incapacitated at home, you know. I bruised all, it just, everything. I was literally dying from head to toe, inside to outside. I was rotting. I mean, I was rotting. There was every physical aspect of my being was getting sicker and sicker every single day. And like I said, and this happened in just a few months. And I had one of my first, well, I think I had one blackout when I was like 17, maybe. But anyway, but I had the only real blackout that I really know of. In the last day of school of June in 2009, my older one came home from school, and had the two younger ones. They were 2 and 5, and my oldest was 9. And they came home, and I was like, we live at a lake. And I said, hey, let's go down to the beach. You know, we'll go down to where the beach is, which is like a couple streets down. And I will load up the wagon with the toys. And they're home, and I'm telling them to get their suits on. And the next thing I know, I'm sitting on a bench at the beach, and my kids are swimming, little kids. I don't know if they got life vests on. I have no clue. I have absolutely no clue. thank God everybody was fine, made it home. Still continued to drink though, even though that wasn't, and it was weird because I was having this, this weird, where a lot of people, I think in one of the stories they describe it where my drinking was to the point where I would 1 minute I would seem like I was completely wasted drunk and could barely stand, and then like 2 minutes later I would seem sober. And it was like it would go back and forth, like my own body didn't know how to handle the liquor and didn't know whether I was sober or whether I was drunk or whether I had to, I mean, it was just the strangest thing. And I wasn't sleeping at all. And I can remember that I would wake up after a couple hours of sort of sleep, if you want to call it really that, and I would be shaking, and the shaking is what would wake me up. I would be shaking so badly that it would wake me up, and I would go into my closet, because by now, most people had caught on. You know, most people, you know, my parents, most people saying my world had gotten very small, but I would go into my closet, and that's where I had, I had booze underneath the my clothes, and I would get down on my knees, and by now, I wasn't drinking in front of anybody at this point, I would just drink shots, and of course, here's the other thing, is that I would drink shots, but I chased it with Gatorade, because I knew the electrolytes in the Gatorade would be good for me. And that would counteract the alcohol with all the electrolytes. I honestly thought this. There was a thought process of not drinking Coke or not drinking water because I needed the electrolytes from the Gatorade. So I would go into my closet but for some reason I got the red Gatorade, which, and I'll explain why this is a bad idea. I would get on my hands and knees and I would be shaking so bad it'd be 3-4 o'clock in the morning and I would just be wanting to go back to sleep and I would be shaking. I'd get on my hands and knees and I would pour a shot into the shot glass, and I'm still using a shot glass, which is ridiculous too, because I don't know, just to drink out of the bottle seemed inappropriate, I suppose. And so I pour a shot and I would drink and I would hold my hands and I would drink it really quickly, and then I would close my, and I would pray and I would count to 10. Because if I could get to 10 without throwing the shot up immediately, then I could take a second shot. And if I could get the second shot down, then I would be able to maybe go back to sleep for like 20 minutes. But I'm drinking it with red Gatorade. So when I'm throwing up, I'm not making it to the bathroom. I'm throwing up all over my clothes. I mean, the disgusting behavior that had set in, that to me was just, had become part of my life, was disgusting. I mean, it was beyond what I could have imagined. And so I would sit there and I would count to 10 and I would be able to get the second shot down, but that would only happen half the time. Half the time, the first shot would come immediately back up. And now I know is that it was actually my body trying to save itself. You know, it was actually my body, when I would get the shot down, it was contracting, because it was actually trying to do a last ditch effort to save me. So finally towards July, and this is, everything's just gotten worse and worse and worse. And so I know that it's up. My mom doesn't know what to do. My parents don't know what to do. My poor husband, who's dying, doesn't know what to do. He's more worried about me, and he's the one dying. And so my mom, I detox my parents' house, which I don't recommend to anybody to ever detox. Because here's the thing, is that it was I was so sick, and knowing what I know now, the dangers that I put myself into of detoxing by myself with my parents, there were so many things that could have gone wrong, and I got really, really, really lucky that they didn't. But detoxing was horrible, and it was painful, and it was the most miserable 3 days of my entire life. And so I got through that, and here's you were talking about moments of clarity, and this was interesting because I was talking to my sponsor the other day, and I was worried about some people, and she said, well, pray for moments of clarity. And it made perfect sense, because in the gray murkiness that I lived in towards the end, one of those times when I was on my closet floor getting ready to take a shot, I had this very clear image, and it was my oldest son, but he was older. He was like 16. And he was having a conversation, and in the conversation was very brief, and he was talking to someone, and he said, yeah, my dad died of ALS when I was 9, and my mom drank herself to death 6 months later. And it was as clear as can be. It was that moment of clarity. And so, as I'm detoxing, and when I hear people say that it was so bad they just wanted to die, I get that. I do, I get that. But for me, and if I had not had kids, or if my kids had been grown, I may have wanted to die also. But I couldn't die on my kids. I couldn't do that. I couldn't do it. They were going through, I just couldn't die on them. So I detoxed. My mom says, let me call the AA hotline. And I was like, okay, I don't even know how she got the number. We didn't know anybody, we didn't know anybody that had been AA. We didn't know anything about it. Except for that one brief time that I'd been a long time ago. She calls AA. And here's another God moment is that she calls and that she's talking to the person and we don't even know what they're going to say. And the woman, about halfway through the conversation, breaks her anonymity to my mother. And this was a person that my mother had known for 15 years, that my mother did not even know there was an alcoholic nor was in the program. It could have been anybody that answered that phone. And it was a friend of my mom's. And she said, Dee, tell Shannon to go to the Lake of the Woods meeting. She will be okay. She'll be okay. And that was a God moment because that conversation became very familiar. It became with a person that cared. And I went. And I didn't care if I had to be sick and white knuckle it the rest of my life because I figured I would. I figured I was so sick, I was so far gone that I could never be well again. I didn't care. I just didn't want to die on my kids. I just was like, just tell me how to live. I don't care if I have to hate every second of it. Just tell me how to live. And amazingly enough, I stayed long enough for the miracle, and little by little, I slept longer and longer, and little by little, everything started to get better, little by little. I don't remember, we have a thing at our first, when people come to our home group and they pick up a 24-hour chip and we do the first step on them, and, I personally don't like it. That's a personal opinion of me, I don't like it, but I don't remember if they first set me. I don't. I honestly don't remember. I have no clue. They may have. Everybody might have been looking right at me and talking to me. I don't remember. It was like la 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 la. It was like, from the Charlie Brown, that teacher, wah 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 wah. I don't have a clue. But I remember. Here's the irony of it is that I remember that when I was in the AA meeting, my drinking wasn't the center of attention. So I came back. And little by little, I started to get better. And I was in the program for 2.5 months when my husband passed away. And I was still very, very, very sick. I was still green. I was still bruised. But I was sleeping a little bit better. I was able to eat a little bit better. And here was the thing, though, is that this program, I had had just enough. I had gotten connected with people just enough that the morning that my husband passed away, it was October 3rd, and it was one of those mornings that are the reasons we live in Virginia in the fall. It was beautiful. All the leaves had already turned, but they were all still on the, they were so, and all the colors were vibrant, and it was a perfect crisp degrees, and the sun was, it was blue sky, like not a cloud in the sky. Blue sky, it was just gorgeous. And the Hokies were playing that day. My husband went to Virginia Tech, and the Hokies were playing. And 3 days before he passed away, he had gone what they call flop neck, and he had lost the ability to hold his head up. And that was one of the last mobilities that he had. And, he didn't want to go out. So we're sitting there, and I decided to make pancakes with my boys, and I hadn't made pancakes in probably 8 years. I don't even know. Nowadays, who makes ham pancakes? You buy them in the store. So I decide, and we get out, and I've got blueberries, and I've got chocolate chips, and we're all going to make all these, and I've got my three boys, and we're in the kitchen, and it's the morning, and the Hokies are going to be coming on, and it's this gorgeous day, this absolutely beautiful day, and I fully, absolutely 100% believe that God said, there's not going to be a better moment. There just wasn't going to be a better moment than that right there. Me and his boys, healthy, making pancakes 10 feet away from him, this beautiful day, just wasn't going to get any better. And so he passed away that morning. And the fact that I had had just enough time in this program that I was able to be calm and hold it together and be there for my boys, that day alone, I can never repay this program. I can never repay this fellowship for that one day of sobriety that they gave me and gave my boys. I can never repay it, ever. And so after he passed away, I completely just threw myself into this program. I got service work. I became a coffee maker. I was voluntold to be a coffee maker, which is perfect. I love it. And shortly after that, I got a sponsor. I got connected with people in this program. One of my very dear friends who's in this program, who's not here, but he told me, he was like, come have dinner with us. He was like, come. And then he was like, Pat and Linda. He's like, Linda needs to be your sponsor. I was like, okay. And so I got a sponsor. I started working the steps. I went to meetings. I did everything that was suggested of me. I didn't question anything. I didn't say that step doesn't apply to me or this meeting doesn't. None of that. I did everything that was suggested. I still do. I don't think for one second I've got this covered. I don't think for one second I can do this by myself. Not one single solitary second. I am huge. You know, I have a sponsor. I talk to her. I see her at meetings. I talk to her. I have a set time that I talk to her once a week, whether I like it or not, whether I feel like I need to or not. I call her because it makes me accountable. You know, it lets her know what's going on in my week. It lets me, you know, it so that she knows where I'm at. You know, and it also, because if we're not used to, as some of your newcomers may not, if you're not used to picking up the phone and calling your sponsor, calling somebody else in the fellowship when things are good, you are not going to do it when your ass is on fire. You're not going to do it. You got it, you know, and so I call my sponsor. I use her. She's there. Luckily my life is great right now. You know, we get in here and we're supposed to talk about, you know, I'm huge on service work also. I've done service work ever since I was that coffee maker. I've done lots of variations of service work. Right now I do a lot of work for the district. I'm the DCM for this district right now. I love it. Just, you know, doing service work at the district level isn't for everybody, and I get that, but there's every area of service work you can do, and they're all over. And sometimes it's just coming to the Memorial Day picnic and helping out, you know. I mean, but get involved. Be in the middle of this program. You know, be in the middle of that triangle. That's the safest place to be. You know, I heard the other day that no matter how far down I get down this path, you know, from the person that's got the 24-hour chip to the person that's got the 47-year chip, we're never any further from the ditch. We're all the same distance from the ditch on the side of the road. We're all right there. The difference is if you've surrounded yourself with this program and this fellowship, you got people that are going to stand there and go, back up, what's going on, back up. You know, that's when you need to get involved in this program. You know, they talk about what it was like, you know, they say, and I know I'm about to run over, and I can't believe it's gone so quick. Am I okay? No. You know, they say when you get up here to speak, they say, okay. They say when you come up and speak, I remember the first time I spoke and I was terrified, and it doesn't really get a lot better, but they say that when you get up to speak, they say, you know, you're supposed to say, you know, what it was like and then what happened and what it's like now. And, you know, and I go through, you know, I basically just told you, you know, my story, but, you know, it's like I look at my life and it's like polar opposites, you know, and I look at, you know, my parents, you know, 5.5 years ago, my parents, and this is the honest truth, they never left the house at the same time. They never would leave their house at the same time because they lived in fear of what was going to happen between me or my husband or my kids or me not paying attention. They never left the house. My parents right now, they were just in Greece. Now they're in Spain. My parents are living their retired life. They've been married 55 years. They are not consumed with fear because of my alcoholism anymore. You were talking about the family and the people that we think we're just doing to ourselves. Oh my goodness, my parents never left the house. Now they're off, they've been in like 20 countries. I can't even count anymore. They're doing exactly what they're supposed to be doing. You know, 5.5 years ago, I was the unhealthiest I've ever been. And just real quickly, when I finally went into the doctors after you know, when the jig was up and I went in and I knew I was dying. I knew it. I'm like, I just need to know how quickly I'm dying. Like, how much time do I have? And I went in and I got the full body workup. They did the blood work. They sent me for an MRI. They sent me to everything, the gastroenterologist. They sent me all over. My liver enzyme count, the normal is 0.02 to 1.2. is the normal range. Mine was 17. I went in 6 months later. My doctor heard me come in. She came out to the waiting room and brought me back because she said, it's at 1 in 6 months. She could not believe it. I went back to the gastroenterologist for a checkup, and he looked at my lab records, and he said, wow. He said, that's pretty amazing. And he said, stay off the hooch. I was like, that was it. We try and complicate things so much. Stay off the hooch. It's just that simple. I mean, what more do you need to hear, right? So now I'm the health. So I go from being the most unhealthy I've ever been to now I am the healthiest I've been in my entire adult life. You know, 5.5 years ago, I know what I was going through, and I know the people that showed up. And that's okay. I wouldn't have expected them to show up because my world had gotten very small, and I didn't have a lot of friends, but that was because I wasn't out there making friends. Now, I have a network of people that if I don't show up for a meeting, or if I do show up for a meeting and I sound like I'm off, they will call me up. They will say, how are you doing? They will come find me. I don't worry that I don't have friends. I don't worry that I am not cared for, okay? You know, I mean, it's an amazing contrast and difference. You know, I went from 5.5 years ago, and this is still one of those things that I work on. And by the way, for those of you that have never spoke before and maybe don't, is that I have to thank you all because I will leave here today feeling like I did a little mini fist step because my hardest thing, my kids I can make the living amends to, my hardest thing is with my late husband. Even though he knew I'd gotten in the program, I was not what he deserved in the end. You know, we had a great life and a great marriage, but he deserved somebody that was more present in the end. And I can't go back. But every time I get up here and I talk about it, I'll leave forgiving myself a little bit more today. So I thank you all for that. But, you know, I felt like, you know, he had loved me very much and that maybe that was it. You know, maybe that was all the love I had deserved from another person, but that's not the way life works. You know, I have an amazing boyfriend in my life and the great thing is that when you're loved by somebody fully like that, you can recognize it when it comes along again. And, you know, I'm very blessed to have him in my life and, you know, he's in the program and boy meets girl, AA campus, you know, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, you know, but no, it is, so far it's going really good. I don't work his program and he doesn't work mine. You know, we might nudge each other a little bit and we need to get to an extra meeting, you know, every now and then, but you know, but no, it's an amazing life. And you know, five and a half years ago, my son, my oldest son, who was 9, you know, I talked about the house that they were living in with this fear and this, you know, everything. My 9-year-old son went to my mom and asked my mom if I was dying the same thing his dad was dying of. My 9-year-old believed that both of his parents had ALS and were dying. Talk about fear. Talk about fear, right? You know? And now, you know, day after tomorrow, that 9-year-old will turn 15. And he is a perfectly normal 15-year-old. And I will get... But I will get to be the first person to wish him happy birthday. I get that. I almost didn't get that. You know, my 8-year-old stayed in his Guardians of the Galaxy costume all day yesterday. All day, you know? I almost missed that. You know, my 11-year-old thinks that he was telling me that they were talking about addictions and he talked about it. They learned it at school and he was talking about nicotine and how bad nicotine is for you. And he said, yeah, mom, and you know about this other addiction they talked about. And I went, oh, alcohol. And he went, no, mom, caffeine. You don't drink. And I went, that's right, I don't. And I said, well, why do you think I got all those AA meetings? And he goes, oh, you go there to help all those people. You're welcome. No, seriously. He lives in a world where he doesn't think of his mom as this dying in her closet. You know, this rotting from the inside out. You know, that's what this program has brought me. You know, that's what was like, and this is what it's like now. And what happened is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. The grace of God brought me here. You know, for those of you who don't believe yet or don't have, you know, a God of your understanding or whatever it may be or don't pray, that's okay because I didn't pray at the end either. I couldn't put two thoughts together in the end, okay? But that doesn't mean that my ass didn't end up in this program because somebody else was praying for me, okay? We need to remember that sometimes we may have forgotten how to pray and we may not have a God of our understanding, but that doesn't mean that somebody else that loves us isn't praying for us. That brings us in here, you know, and then we work on finding it ourselves, and that's okay. You know, that's okay. It's all progress. You know, I'm going to finish up real quickly. I'm sorry I ran over, but when I was 2 years sober, a guy came up to me that had gone to, that goes to our home group meetings, and he came up to me, and for 2 years, it was right after the day I picked up my 2-year chip, and he came up to me, and even though we'd been in meetings and I'd heard him share, we had never had a one-on-one conversation, he came up to me after the meeting, and he said, you know, he said, it's so good to hear you share. He said, it's so good to see you pick up that chip. Because I got to tell you, when you came in here, I thought you were too late. Too late for Alcoholics Anonymous. You don't hear that very often. But the reality of this disease is that there are countless of us out there, countless of us, that are still sick and suffering. There are countless of us that don't make it, that don't make it. There's a gentleman in Fredericksburg that was going to go into rehab on Monday, and he overdosed the Saturday before. He was scheduled to go into rehab, and he overdoses on heroin the Saturday before. He thought he had time. He thought he had time. You know, there are those of us in here who can't grasp it enough, and we decide to take a permanent option. We know those people. A permanent option to our, you know, to our problems. We know those people. Okay? That's the reality of this disease. But for us today, it's not too late. For us today, we sit here, we live in hope. We have a chance. This is a miracle that we are living inside of. We have the solution. It is an absolute, absolute miracle that we live in. Every single day, this program and this fellowship continues to save my life. Every day. Everything I have. My children's lives, my parents' lives, everything. This program, the Alcoholics Anonymous, is the miracle, and we get it today. We get it. We have a shot. We just got to take it. It's an amazing life. It's an amazing life, and I thank you all very, very, very much for letting me share.